Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I'm your host for this weekend show. Shad had a little bit of a break at the tail end of the week, but he'll be back with us early next week. Now this weekend show, I'm going to take a step back and look broadly, big picture, at the markets. Not just commodities, but U.S. equity markets, currencies, and the bond market because, look, let's face it, we seem to be in the middle of summer trading. Summer trading is slow, and that gives us the ability to take a step back and see maybe what the markets are telling us about where we could be going once we get out of this slow summer trading season. No time frame on how long this summer trading is going to last, but we can at least see some of the moves going on slowly under the surface to analyze, well, just where the markets and key trends are moving. I am kicking off the first two segments here with our good friend Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. That's read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. Also writes a retail newsletter called In the No Trader. And again, I've mentioned it before, Rick also writes this new piece called 7-Eleven, where he picks no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs. Now, Rick, big picture, you can't look at any financial website and not see the term inflation thrown around in many articles, and any market commentary always has that inflation comment tied to whatever comment that author is making. Rick, what do you think? Is inflation the most important thing that investors need to be considering day after day right now?
Well, hi, Corey. I think it's a combination of looking at actual inflation numbers and then also how are investors positioned for what they expect in the future as far as inflation. And it's a combination of that that I think right now is probably the most important two things to be looking at as the basis for not only trading the bond market, but also its influence on the equity markets. And so, you know, we can kind of let's talk about that piecemeal. As far as actual inflation, well, the CPI and PPI numbers came out and kind of very clearly show that we have much higher inflation than was expected. Clearly much higher than the Fed expected. And it's real. I mean, these, especially, you know, when you take out, I never love the idea of taking out the what they call, quote, the volatile food and energy piece of it, because to the average consumer, I'm not sure there is anything more important than the price of food that they pay in a grocery store and the price they pay at the gas station to fill up their cars. These are things that you can't live without. You've got to eat and you've got to be able to get around. So, I still kind of chuckle at the fact that they'll say, let's take a look at some of these numbers without food and energy. Secondly, investors are still, despite the fact that the 10-year has gone from, what was it, 1.75 on the high this year down to about 1.3 right now, they are still positioned for upcoming inflation. And they've been correct. If anything, I'd say Fed Chairman Powell has been incorrect, where he's purposely trying to make this less of an issue than the investing public sees it to be. Even with rates having come down and spreads having narrowed, the reality is that with a 1.3% 10-year that bottomed last week at 1.25, bounced up to actually got over a little over 1.4 and then has, you know, slid down to 1.3 today. The marketplace is still showing, despite the 40 bips of pullback in, or 45 bips in pullback that we've seen over the course of the last 3-4 months, inflation is still a concern for investors. And on the front cover of our supposedly irrelevant factors report that goes out to institutions, my clients each week, we actually show a table of 10 different markets. And depending upon which ones are in bullish formation on the charts, we actually can get a pretty good clue of how investors are gauging upcoming inflationary pressures. And since last September, it has continuously shown inflationary concerns. And investors have been right because inflation has moved up significantly. So this is, you know, despite the fact that lumber has fallen and given back almost the entire 2000, in fact, I think it has given up the entire 2021 rally, it's still well above where it was from pre-pandemic levels of a year and a half ago. But despite that, and despite the fact that oil's come off 10% or so from the high, you're still talking about $70 crude, and we were at 40 bucks. So there really is inflation that affects people's pocketbook, and you're not seeing wage increases anything close to offsetting that. The money you get in the bank, or let's say that, you know, even a 10-year yield at 1.3% does you nothing of no good when you've got inflation running where it is now. So it, in many ways, this is truly an issue for the investing public, both professional investors, but also, you know, mom and pop, the retail investor, who's still trying to figure out this game of what to do and how much money to keep in cash. And you know, can you still fuel the equity market because there's nowhere else to put your money? And these are the ongoing issues.
Now, Rick, isn't that the key point? And something that not a whole lot of people have talked about is that even with higher inflation expectations, in a way, does that not make the mom and pop investor, even bigger institutions, say that they need to have their money at work, which means their money needs to be in the markets, which helps support the market?
Well, it does, but it also, the problem becomes that, and the Fed's done this now for, you know, years, as interest rates went lower and lower, you got pushed into riskier assets because, especially, look, take a 65-year-old or a 70-year-old in the U.S. who, or in Canada, they rely somewhat on Social Security, but they also, at this point in their lives, have generally moved well away from being in the stock market, and the bulk of their portfolio is in fixed income instruments. And when they're yielding as little as they are, people are having a real hard time making ends meet. The average person is having a difficult time. And this is the issue for them, because if you're 70 years old, you don't want to be forced into the risky equity market. And look, it's done phenomenally well for people who put their money in equities, were virtually on all-time highs. So you've had a phenomenal run. But at some point, that's going to correct. And you don't want to be a 70-year-old when the market decides to correct 20 or 25%. That's hugely painful. So this is a real issue. It obviously, depending upon what your age is, affects you more or less, you know, if you're older or not. But the reality is that putting money in the bank, or we're taking 1.3% from the U.S. government on a 10-year instrument simply to get 1.3%, is not a particularly good deal. More specifically, if bond yields break further and we get down towards, I'd say, 1.18, 1.15, somewhere in there, that's probably the area that I walk away from all of my bond investments that I've had and walk away for good, because it simply doesn't do me any good to have my money there. It's because if rates ultimately go higher, which I think they will, then you're going to lose money. You're going to lose more money holding your bonds As rates go higher, the price of bonds go lower. And most people, we had a, let's call it a 40-year bull market in bonds, right? In round numbers, let's say from 1980 to 2020, bonds went up. And people not only got the yield on the bonds, but they had tremendous capital appreciation. To me, those days are done. And we're not going back down to the 40 basis points low that we saw last year. I doubt we break under 1%. And if we do, from the first week in January this year, there's a gap, an unfilled price gap in the 10-year from just about 1% down to 95 basis points or so. So to me, if we get anything near there, which I'd say is if you're at 115, 1.15, anything around there, all the way down to 95 bips, is where I will be telling everyone to say goodbye to bonds forever, because you lose money if unless rates crumble and go back down to 2020 lows, you're going to lose money on the bonds as rates move higher. You're locking in, let's say, 1%, even if it's 1.2%. You're locking that in. And as rates go higher, you'll collect your 1.2%, but you're gonna lose it on the fact that your money's worth less because of inflation going higher. And your bonds, to me, we've started a secular bear market in bonds such that there's no value to holding the bonds other than you guarantee yourself the meager return at the cost of price loss on the actual bonds themselves. It's just a bad deal. So if you're not a pension fund, an endowment fund, somebody who just has to have bonds, then for the average person, to me, it's not the right asset to be in. And the Fed has essentially forced you to go into equities because there is nowhere else to put your money. And yes, you could go into cryptos, you could go into gold. I mean, there are some alternative assets, but generally, most people look at the equity market and the bond market as the bulk of where their investable dollars are going to go. And it's the danger of having all the kind of free money and, you know, that the Fed continually pumps into the marketplace. Once that stops and the game changes and they're not fueling the bull market, then you need corporate profits and, you know, just good old standard stuff on its own to drive you higher. But if you don't have the Fed, and at some point they are going to taper back. And, you know, if rates ultimately, let's say the 10-year makes its way up to 3.5% over the next couple of years, where do you think stocks are going to go when people start having some alternative? If you can get 3.5% on your money and it's U.S. federal tax free, then it starts becoming a possible alternative to taking on the risk of the equity market. But at 1.2%, 1.3%, 1%, to me, there's no deal there at all. It's a losing deal.
Fair enough, Rick. And really, it sounds like what you're outlining here is that the potential downside for investing in bonds far outweighs any sort of minimal upside you might get in terms of the capital gains aspect. And then you're not getting any yield on it, especially at current levels, right? Or at least not attractive yields. But I do want to circle back around to your comment on inflation and some of the market showing you that, you know, inflation is still around. Look at where copper is. Look at where oil is, right? Even lumber is still a little bit higher than its pre-pandemic levels. But what about the gold market? I thought gold was supposed to be the best hedge against inflation. And yeah, gold's up, but if you actually go back to pre-pandemic, so let's look at the high from March of last year, it was right around 1700. That was the exact high. And right now we're at 1800 in gold. So that's not a huge move for how much inflation we're seeing. What's the disconnect here?
I think the disconnect is that you started getting some alternative asset classes, more specifically cryptos, that people have decided to put some money in as a hedge against a falling U.S. dollar as a hedge against just, you know, governments controlling the flow of money as compared to individuals. So, you know, the crypto market has taken, if that didn't exist, I suspect the price of gold would be far higher. But gold peaked in the summer, I think it was August of last year. And it, in the big decline that you saw in gold from, you know, over, I don't know, what was it? Must be something near 2075, give or take, was the all-time high, down to the move at 1675 earlier this year. That's a $400 drop. That's, you know, 20%. And I think it's because cryptos have taken, let's call it, money flow away from the gold market, the you know, just somewhere else to park your money. And when Bitcoin moved up as much as it did, people started just getting in who know nothing about it, but just kind of go, like, I want to be a part of it. And of course, at this point, a lot of those people have losses because Bitcoin topped at, what, $63,000, $64,000, and now it's half of that. So not a surprise that people were, you know, some people are getting really badly crushed in the crypto space, but I think that has something to do with why gold isn't higher than it would have been. I do actually like where gold recently bottomed a month ago. I bought some more. It's, when gold got to 1775, I bought some more GLD for myself. And I, in general, it's, you know, it's kind of bounced and done decently. I really would not want to see those lows taken out under 1750, somewhere around there. At that point, I think gold is in trouble. And we could easily get back to 1675 and, you know, kind of the lows that we saw early this year. And if those levels give way, then gold can go to $1,500 and it makes it a much more questionable type of hold over time. So we just recently stopped somewhere near, I don't know, 1835, give or take, and we're trading 1815 or so. So, you know, we've bounced. We're holding on to that. The dollar hasn't rallied all that much more since, you know, in the last couple, last week or so, it's been fairly steady. And I think that from what I read, the fundamentals are still decent for gold. But you've got to kind of listen to what the market tells you, too. And right now, you really don't want to see 1750 taken out on the downside.
Okay. Hey, Rick, very clear target right there. And then right after 1750, yeah, you got to look to that 1675 almost level of that most recent low this year. Now, Rick, let's then go to the U.S. equity markets in terms of individual sectors. Any opportunities that you're seeing? This kind of ties into your 7-11 piece where you pick 7 of the 11 spider ETFs, maximum of 7, that is. Right now, it seems like we have a lot of money concentrated in big tech and growth. That rotation has gone back there, and even with weak breadth for the markets, so just a limited number of stocks holding these markets up, that's where the money has flowed. Do you still see an opportunity here? What sectors do you like within these markets?
Well, so it's kind of a mixture because the lower interest rates, the pullback helps big cap tech. And we've seen them outperform very nicely over the cyclical areas like industrials, financials, energy, materials over the last couple months. As interest rates pulled back, that's a real boost for large cap equity, large cap tech. And we've seen tech outperform significantly. In fact, since June 1st, I put this in a piece I wrote last week for In the Know Trader. If I remember correctly, tech and maybe one other sector was up since June 1st and everything else was trailing the S&P. So the question becomes, when do rates bottom? And at what point do, if we keep going down in rates, at some point that's going to be a negative for the growth, big cap tech too. It's certainly not good for financials. You've seen energy names come off significantly. As of yesterday's close, I saw, you know, XOP and XLE, benchmarks for the energy area, you know, trading on their lowest level in 3 months or so. So oil itself has come off about 10%, but these names have come off far more than that. And the low interest rates is not particularly good for those, you know, for the cyclical parts. So you've got a smattering of sectors here now that are kind of, I still like tech. I'm overweight tech. I am overweight financials because I think that financials, this is a tactical type move in the, let's say, the XLF. The decline is more tactical. It's not strategic, meaning that it's short term. And we try to look out at least 6 months in where we hold a max of the seven. So we look, just to make it clear, we hold no less than five and no more than seven of the 11 macro spider ETFs. So in other words, XLF for financials, XLK for technology, and so on. There are 11 sectors to the S&P 500. And we are outperforming with, we started the 7-Eleven market report last August 1st. As of June 30th, 10 months into the first year, we are outperforming the S&P by 371 basis points, simply by being in the right sectors at the right time and in avoiding, for, you know, we've avoided utilities, we've avoided staples. I've been out of healthcare since January 1st. I have not been in real estate, I think, at all. And even though real estate is probably the second best performer year to date, I still didn't have enough to go actually overweight them. So we've been able to avoid generally the underperformers and stay, you know, our head above water in the outperformers. And look, if you're in the money management industry, or you're doing this for yourself at home and you say, yeah, I could just buy spiders and get the S&P's return, the subscription cost on this is less than $100 a month. And we've got you outperforming the S&P by 3.71%. So depending upon, you know, if you have $100,000 in the market and you're outperforming by 3.71%, you know, you've made three times the cost of the subscription. It's, if not four times, it's significant. And it's simply, you know, looking at the fundamentals, the quantitative models, and the technical view, and putting those together to figure out what are the sectors to be in. And right now, I told you we're overweight tech, we're overweight, let's see, still some of the cyclical parts, because again, I think this is a short-term decline, and we're basically stay away from, so I'm not in healthcare, I'm not in utilities, I'm not in staples, I'm not in real estate. I think those are the four I'm not in currently. So it's a little of this, and, you know, I've got cyclicals and growth on, and so far it's working.
Very interesting, right? Kind of a balance there too, and it doesn't sound like
a little barbell.
Exactly, mm-hmm. But you're not getting sucked in like, I don't know, it seems like we've been hearing from everybody, oh, everybody's in tech, you have to be in growth, you have to be in large tech. Doesn't sound like that's where you are necessarily, but you are at least positioned in some of those as well, right? So I think it's all about where markets go from here.
Where do markets go from here? I was talking to an institutional client yesterday and saying, I just have a little hunch that we're getting closer towards a top, 4,400 in the S&P to 4,500. I don't think we go beyond that. Without some type of pullback. And it doesn't, you know, I know, you know, Mike Wilson at Morgan Stanley, my old shop where I had been chief strategist, he's calling for a 10 to 15% market decline. I don't think we're going to see that. Credit markets are not showing in any way that a sell-off like that is imminent. You see a problem show up in the credit markets if there was real stress and concerns about what was coming. And right now, I don't see that with the credit spreads that I monitor. They've moved up a couple of basis points in the last week or two, but nothing significant. And so for right now, I'm not agreeing at all with Mike on that call. In 2014, a month or so before I parted with Wells Fargo, I put out a piece that at the time got a little buzz, but mostly because it seemed like an outlandish call. The S&P was trading at 2,200 in June of 2014, and I said that within 10 years, the S&P would be at 5,000. That's more than a double. And people said I was nuts and da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, here we are in 2021, and we're already in the 4,300s. We're only 700 points away. I don't think we get much, you know, like, so if I'm right that it's going to take those 10 years to kind of get there, then there isn't all that much more upside in the immediate future. So I'm very careful about the type stocks I buy now. I'll only buy stuff on pullbacks that look like they have really solid fundamentals, good earnings revisions, and show downside exhaustion in the models that I look at from a timing perspective, so that I'm buying something that has to some degree gotten beaten up, but still has analysts loving the name and, you know, good upside to the analyst target. So I'll give you an example. Like last week, I bought Fiserv for myself, FISV. It's got good fundamentals. It's got really good solid upside of like, I think it's 30% or more to target. It's got downside exhaustion signals on the type stuff that I look at. And I paid 108 and change. And this morning I looked, it was trading 111. You know, so it's up a few percent in a time that the market's really not up much at all. It's that type of stuff where if I'm going to put money into the market now, I don't buy something on new all-time highs. I buy something that's been knocked down but still has the fundamental community behind it and positive earnings revisions.
Okay, that makes sense, Rick. Hey, Rick, it's always great having you on the show. Thank you for this update on where exactly you're trading, where you see these markets positioned. And as I said on the onset, now is the time to do that because it's slow trading and we need to understand where these markets are going to move post this summer slow trading session. Rick, it's great having you on the show, as I mentioned. Thank you, as always, for your time. We'll chat again in approximately another month. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend and great rest of the month of July, Rick. Thank you.
You too, Corey. Thanks for having me.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.